I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with the journalist, author, and science policy expert, Bina Venkataraman, author of The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age.
Currently, Bina is the editorial page editor of the Boston Globe and a fellow at New America. Previously, she served as senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama White House and also advised the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology during the Ebola outbreak.
Bina brings a true long view, interdisciplinary, not to mention intergenerational perspective to her work, something that we could all benefit greatly from right now. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Bina. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
So, what's at the top of your mind right now?
A lot of what's at the top of my mind is the election and what might happen with the U.S. presidential election. So I would say a lot of near-term thoughts about that and what it means for the pandemic we're in, what it means for the climate crisis, what it means for racial justice. So kind of I would say a little bit of impending doom, even though I'm the optimist about what's going to happen between now and the November election.
Mm. And of course, with your role at the Boston Globe, you're kind of seated somewhere in the middle of all of these things. Could you talk about how we should be thinking about this current moment?
Sure. So I do try to take a little bit of a long view, even of moments of crisis, and ask the question of, how can a moment of crisis be seen through the lens of history? How can you think about it as an opportunity for really dramatic change? So if you think about what happened after the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression and just the kind of political will that came together in this country for social programs that, of course, were most famously known as the New Deal, but sort of radical changes to society. And take your mind off the election for a moment. Just think about the pandemic we're living through. I was just looking at footage of Rue de Rivoli in Paris, France, and it's one of the major thoroughfares on the right bank of the Seine. And it's been shut down mostly to car traffic. It's been taken over largely by bike and pedestrian traffic. And it's sort of this, I think, example of what I don't think is all that common right now, but is happening in these little pockets around the globe, which is that people are using crisis to reimagine what society should look like, to make changes that before were seen as kind of impossible or that we just couldn't do because there wasn't enough, I don't know, motivation or it would be too inconvenient. I just remember, you know, always having to go sit in my doctor's office if I wanted to get checked up for something. And there's still a benefit of doing that for certain things. You know, if you sprain an ankle, you want it checked out. But there's so much that we do that we can do virtually. And this pandemic has sort of jump-started and I think overcome some inertia to doing things that's been there for decades. So I guess I think about it from the perspective of, yes, we're in sort of this acute crisis where everything seems like do or die in this moment, but it's also just a real pivotal time to take yourself out of just the horse race of who's going to win the election or even just the trying to predict on a near-term timescale when the vaccine's going to be available. Those things are important, but almost everyone is fixated on the short term because we're anxious about that. And few people are able to kind of lift their gaze and think about what is the broader meaning of this? Or even how do we think about living through this time in history? What will we tell our grandchildren or what will we tell people about it in the future? And it's really hard on a day-to-day basis for so many of us. I have to say it's one of the most challenging times that I've lived through myself. But if I can take a little bit of that perspective of how would I tell this story when I'm 70? How would I talk about this time? It's actually a bit refreshing because I kind of get to this point of, hey, you know, these are going to be some serious war stories about living through. It's like having listened to stories from World War II veterans, you know, about living in Europe in that time.
Yeah. I mean, your new book, The Optimist Telescope, you go into this idea of projective thinking, the notion of generational responsibility. How should we be thinking about getting past the sort of instant gratification culture that's become so omnipresent?
I think it's really difficult, especially right now. So there's a thing that happens when you have scarcity of time or bandwidth or resources, which so many people do because there's also an economic crisis happening now. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to take yourself out of that instant moment. So if you're trying to put food on the table, how do you start thinking about the future? How do you start getting that sort of on your plate? But there are a few ways to do that. And I guess part of why I mentioned that idea of, you know, what kind of stories are we going to tell when we're older is that I think there's actually something that we can get in the short run from thinking long term right now, which is to say some relief from the anxiety and the fixation on just that immediate future that's so hard to control and so full of uncertainty and murkiness and possibly hardship. So how do we get out of that instant gratification culture, but also that fixation on the very immediate future? And one of the ways is to stop measuring ourselves by near-term metrics all the time. So we do this in our personal lives. We're constantly looking at how many emails we've replied to, or, you know, did you get in your steps that day? You might be neglecting actually things that matter to you over a longer time period. So I tell people to think about whether it's in their lives or in their work, or even in society, to think about replacing short-term metrics with milestones. So at least once a week, you should have some time where you reflect on whether you're making progress on those kind of goals that you want to reach at the end of your life, even, let alone, you know, 10, 15 years from now. So carving into your life some of that measurement so that you are not just always measuring what you've immediately done, which can sometimes be ephemeral, you know, whether it's a company making a quarterly profit that then turns out to evaporate the next quarter or doesn't matter much in 10 years because the company's neglected something that was a huge opportunity or a huge risk, like before the financial crisis. So that happens in our lives. It happens in organizations. It even happens in society. If we're just looking at the stock market, we might ignore a pandemic, for example, which we've seen happen in this country over this year. So measurement is a really important way to kind of get out of the instant gratification loop where you're just trying to get those immediate goals and you're not really focused on the long term. Another way that I really think is important is to really stoke the imagination. So we started with that idea of what kind of stories would you tell about this time? There's a really practical way to bring that into your life, which is to write a letter to the future. So you could write a letter to your future self. You could write a letter to a niece or nephew or kid or grandkid. And think about a time period that's really outside the time that you think about on a daily basis. So I would say at least 20 years in the future. Sit down, imagine the life of this future person, if it's your future self. Start to think about what that person might care about or what they might be facing or where they might be, and populate that image with real details. And there's a reason for this, which is that it's so hard for us to imagine the future because we get so much vivid, visceral response from what's right in front of us. So we can smell the donut on the counter. We can see what we want to buy at the store. And all of that is just sensory detail that reinforces our focus on the present. But when we need to think about the future, we actually have to use our imaginations. We have to conjure the future in our minds. And that's not always so easy to do. But having a person you can imagine opening this letter can help you kind of bring those details to the fore and really paint a picture for yourself. And then I would say in this letter, you know, try to explain some of the decisions you're making today to this future version of yourself or this future, you know, young person grown up. And what's useful about that is that it will start to clarify for you what decisions you're making in your life that might have reverberations beyond this job you're in today, or beyond whatever family situation you're in today, or beyond the pandemic, or beyond the political situation. And it'll help you connect to some of those long-term concerns, both for yourself, but really also for the planet. I got to know a person while I was working on the Optimus telescope who is a behavioral economist who started this effort called Dear Tomorrow. And she encourages all these people to write letters to be opened in the year 2050 to help people imagine how the climate might be different in that time. And it draws on research around perspective taking that shows that if you can really empathize with another human being, it changes your ability to take what's an abstract idea of the future and to really make it more real in your present life. I think of it as imaginative empathy. Some of the literature calls it perspective taking. Another thing that I would love to advise as a way to kind of unlock ourselves from the trap of the present is to pick a shared heirloom that you want to commit yourself to. So I say this because I had my own experience with a family heirloom, not a shared heirloom, but one that, you know, belongs to me for the moment, which is an instrument I inherited from my great grandfather, who was a music and art critic in India in the early 20th century. And I had this experience of getting this beautiful instrument. It's called a Dilruba. It has a very melancholy sound. And realizing all of a sudden that I had this role, that I was not just me in my own life and all my immediate concerns, that I was actually a descendant of someone who had saved this instrument, and that I was an ancestor to someone, probably my nieces, who I would want to pass this on to. And that it was my role to kind of shepherd this heirloom in time. And I got the instrument sort of around the time I was working on the Optimus telescope, around the time I was thinking about these ideas in the book about long-term thinking and really trying to wrestle with this, how do we imagine future generations? Because we know even in our own lifetimes, right? Like when I grew up, it was like dial-up internet. And now, you know, it's a smartphone in my pocket that's radically transformed almost every way that I live. And that has happened in just a few decades. And I think it's really hard for us, seeing the pace of technological change, seeing the pace of cultural change, to really imagine future generations in a way that brings it home for us. And what I think is useful about an heirloom or approach where you think about heirlooms is that you don't have to imagine people millions of years from now. All you have to do is think about what's valuable to pass on to the next generation and how to help the next generation create meaning and value around that so that they want to pass it on to the next. And this plays out if you think about our national parks. They're kind of shared heirlooms. They have resources behind them. There are rules, you know, the government has laws protecting these lands. And they also really importantly get used by every generation. Every generation goes and visits them and creates their own experiences and their own memories in the Grand Canyon or Yosemite. And that's really important because if you want something to be carried on over time, each generation has to actually find it relevant to them. Otherwise, they'll just say, why are we paying our taxes? Why are they supporting the national parks? So to bring it back to the personal, I think the way to think about this in your own life is that whether it's in your work or your neighborhood or your community or just how you think about what you're going to do for society, for whether you think of that as a global society or your country, to think about not just what you're contributing today, but to think about what you're contributing in terms of a shared heirloom. So are you contributing to sharing or creating knowledge that you think can be useful to future generations? Are you creating art? Are you protecting a local forest or helping to protect an aquifer? I really think of it as being at the scale of the planet. I really think of our planet as a shared heirloom, and we are trying to keep it clean and healthy and have it be supportive of life on Earth in its many forms and of civilization for future generations. And to think of it that way kind of changes it because it means that it's not something I can use every drop of today because it has to be there for the next generation, but it's also something that each generation needs to use in some way and have meaning and interaction with. Mm.
Your example of the Dilruba, which you so beautifully tell in your TED Talk, which I encourage everyone to listen to, has a very specific ability and power in that it is like a nonverbal way to connect across time. And it's a specific sound you refer to, a kind of almost a primordial sound. So I did want to mention that in the personal, it seems to help to activate a sense that connects you throughout time through that.
I think that's really true. And, you know, we kind of fail in the cognitive exercise of trying to grasp the future, but we need some way to connect with it that feels more visceral, right? That feels like it helps us imagine it and make it come alive for us. And yes, for me, it was that piece of music. I think for some people, it might be staring at a beautiful mountain range and thinking of, you know, the centuries
of the same vista. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And who might have been there before.
I wanted to bring up this idea of interdisciplinary thinking, which is how you approach, obviously, all of your work, which is unique today, unfortunately. But you draw from biology and psychology, economics. And I was particularly struck by this idea that you learned from a psychologist about climate change and despair being the general sentiment. What do you think people need to feel to take part in change? I know you've talked about this a bit, but specifically in terms of this idea of despair, how do we create change in this sort of sustained way around the idea of despair?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a delicate balance here because you don't want to bury your head in the sand when you hear that the climate is warming, when you see the wildfires in California right now, when you look at what's happening around the globe. You don't want to turn a blind eye to that. And so I think that there are a lot of warning signs. There's a lot to be concerned by in terms of how the planet is changing, in terms of our impact on the planet, and also our failure to really act enough on climate change, really across global societies. So I don't want to say that we shouldn't look at that squarely in the face and see it for what it is, but there is, in the psychology of thinking about the future, as you mentioned, there is this idea that if you think that it's all going to hell in a handbasket, if you think doomsday is coming, you're going to be more likely to just sort of party like there's no tomorrow, because there's a kind of nihilism to believing that the future's written and that it's written to bring despair. And I think right now, in particular, with the state of our politics and with this pandemic and not really, you know, knowing or being able to see a light at the end of the tunnel, the economic crisis, plus, you know, the climate crisis, which is predating a lot of this, that it's easy to fall into that kind of despair for a lot of people. It's easy to feel like there's nothing you can do to change it. And I think it's very important, and I think what the literature does bear out, is that it's important to have a sense of agency. So you need to feel like things you can do, choices you can make, actually have an impact on the future. And when it comes to climate change, that's particularly challenging because each individual, while we can make choices to ride a bike or to use less resources or to fly less, which most of us are doing right now, it can feel like that doesn't add up to enough because the systems that support us or support our society are still running on fossil fuels or still contributing to this warming effect. It can feel like not enough.
Yeah.
And so I think with climate change, one thing that's really important to do is to be in community and conversation with others who are also taking actions, and to recognize that the individual power you have is beyond, you know, whether you recycle that yogurt container. It is about how you vote, and not just in a presidential election year, but all the way up and down the ticket. It's about how you use your power as a consumer to decide that certain companies are not worth your support or certain products are not worth your support. And that collectively, we do have a lot of influence. And I think from the psychological point of view, to recognize the places where you can make decisions. So I talk about this exercise used in the book in the business environment to a large extent. And there was an investment firm I wrote about in the Optimist Telescope that uses it called Perspective Hindsight. And it's this technique for imagining an outcome as if it's already happened. So you say to yourself, let's use it for climate change. And let's say we actually solved the climate crisis. Let's assume we solved it. Now, let's ask how and why we solved it. So what did we do? What kinds of decisions were made? What happened? What did I do that contributed to that? What did my neighborhood do? What did my state do? What did my community do? What did my country do? And it's a way of kind of taking yourself out of the trap of this is just an impossible outcome, to clarify what actually are the choices that we have before us. And I think it's the kind of thinking that we need for particularly doomsday scenarios. And I would say we need the opposite when we're too optimistic. So, you know, the problem's going to get solved. Innovation's going to solve it. You know, there's a lot of this in Silicon Valley, this idea that they'll come up with the technology to solve that problem. Well, I always encourage people to do the opposite for those kinds of scenarios and to say, what if it fails? How and why did it fail? And start to create that awareness of all the ways that decisions in your control could contribute to that failure. Some things are not in your control.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up this idea, which connects to imagination, whereas often existential risk experts or disaster analysts will look at gaming out, if we make this choice, what happens, rather than assuming we've won, how did we get there? And I think that plays to your idea of imagination. I also want to bring up the Silicon Valley point you made, which is interesting, which is, you know, where were they when we needed system-based supply chain thinking 6 months ago. So I think that what hopefully we'll learn through this process is that actually the promise of Silicon Valley actually showed itself as simply ad tech and really not, you know, appropriate, actionable systems-based thinking, which is what we would expect. Where was AI when we needed to get masks to people?
It's a really interesting point you raise. And I think one thing that's been really uncomfortable for a lot of people, but maybe needed to be made more obvious, is that we consider ourselves, the U.S. is the epicenter, as we say it, of biomedical innovation, of technological innovation, right? We think of ourselves as the world capital of those things. And I'm sitting here in Boston, where we think of ourselves as leading medical place in the world, but look at us. More than 190,000 people have died of COVID. We have more than any other country in the world in terms of deaths and cases. And we're just utterly failing despite having all the resources to solve this. And I think you're right. It comes down to what kind of problems or have we really been preparing to solve? Have they been problems where I have a technology, I have an app for that? Or problems that are real. And I was sitting with a group of people, some scientists and technologists and policy people around the Ebola epidemic. And we were in a room and we were looking for just people to come up with different kinds of solutions to advise the White House on what should be done to kind of create this response. And one of the technology innovators who will remain nameless for this podcast in the room said, you know, we should create Wi-Fi hotspots because there's so much lack of wireless technology or access to the internet in rural Africa and West Africa, where the outbreak was the worst, where the epidemic was killing so many people. And that way people can report symptoms and they can report cases. And it was just like this crazy idea that was about just throwing technology at a problem that was actually going to create places where people would gather and spread an infectious disease. And so it just had to be thrown out the window, but it was...
They would call that unintended consequences.
Right, right. You know what I mean? Thankfully, it was shot down by some of the epidemiologists in the room.
The myopic nature of Silicon Valley that has taken over our economy and taken over a large part of our social well-being. Hopefully, we'll have a reckoning through this process if it's discussed and if they're held to task. But I did want to bring up the moment you were advising the Obama administration with the Ebola epidemic. You were part of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology on that epidemic. You know, one of the things we've been thinking about a lot is what's really unprecedented is how the continuum stopped. I mean, there were learnings from that that were very, very clear. And then there was a pandemic response created and it was whole cloth thrown out. And so I'd love to hear from you the importance or possibly the description in a specific way of maybe that being the root of our problems about how we're not passing things on. I just kept thinking about your thinking about long view, generational responsibility, and then what happened 4 years ago.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a need to pass on knowledge of the past. And one of the stories I tell in the Optimus Telescope is about the nuclear power plant in Onagawa, Japan, which the reason you haven't heard of it the way you've heard of Fukushima is that it did not have a meltdown during the earthquake and tsunami of 2011. And the reason for that is that the engineer who was behind that particular nuclear power plant in Onagawa had this knowledge of his hometown shrine flooding from a tsunami in the year 869, and he insisted on that power plant being built with a higher seawall and farther back from the coast, even though it was closer to the epicenter of the earthquake than Fukushima Daiichi. And so this idea of having a long view and bringing history into how we prepare for the future is so important. But also history can trap us sometimes. So I don't want to say it's sort of uniform, because if you just anticipate that what's happened in the past is what's going to happen in the future, you can find yourself flat-footed when these sort of unprecedented, or at least once in a generation, once in a multi-generation events happen. So the pandemic response that was put in place in the Obama administration, in particular in the National Security Council, there was a pandemic preparedness response team that was disbanded by President Trump. But it's not just that. I mean, people were focused on that a lot in the news because it's just a very clear example of President Trump gutting some of the personnel that you need to plan for these kinds of events and anticipate them and track them happening abroad so that you know to be ready, you know, for what's going to happen in the U.S. And it all matters. It's not that it doesn't matter, but it's even more fundamental than that. I think the failure is also just the failure to be able to imagine how bad this could get, to take seriously scientists. You know, we have a White House and a president that just manipulate scientists to have facts serve its own agenda. The president was so concerned, speaking of short-term metrics, with the stock market and with having the testing numbers look low at the very superficial level, that we missed a critical window in the U.S. to test people. And testing is a way of containing the spread of the outbreak. And all of those early mistakes just had such huge consequences and gave us a scale of an outbreak and epidemic that is just unforgivable. And it is just truly, I think, political failure at multiple levels. But in passing the torch, so if you think about the transition between the two administrations, there was actually a kind of role play war game exercise about pandemics that was played with Trump administration officials and some Obama administration officials. But what's so interesting about that, Politico did a great story about this, is that about two thirds of the people who played that from the Trump administration were no longer in the administration by early 2020 when this pandemic was coming to US shores. So here you have an administration that, right, like where people drop like flies. So it just goes to show you just yet another reason why you need public servants, you need people who will stay, you need stability in leadership if you want to be able to be ready for future threats.
Mm. In March, you oversaw the Boston Globe's criticism of Donald Trump's response to COVID-19. The paper ran an op-ed titled, "A President Unfit for a Pandemic," with the subtitle line, "The President Has Blood on His Hands." I'm wondering, that was March 30th. So now, more than 5 months later, what's your current assessment of things?
I wrote that editorial, it was on behalf of our editorial board. And at the time, it was a little bit leaning out to the point that, you know, I got an email from Gloria Steinem, which is will forever be like, I'm going to frame it as soon as I can go to a framer again. But it was basically, it was kind of a bold thing to say at the moment, because we were just kind of going into what became this wave of deaths in the country. And I felt very strongly, because of timing being everything in the pandemic, that the political failings we were seeing were going to have devastating consequences. It was clear that they were already coming to play out, and that there was accountability for that. And now that it's borne out, am I happy it's borne out? No, of course not. I wish I would have been proven wrong. It's one of those things like you don't want to be the Cassandra. You want society to be saved or spared from the doom you're predicting. And I think what's clear is that there have been many, many more mistakes since the end of March. Everything from hyping fake treatments for COVID to scaling back the guidance for testing to failing to get tests to people to just really callously responding to this epidemic in a way that I think has made it far worse, politicizing mask wearing. So there's more blood on his hands than I even imagined at the end of March.
Mm. Could you express or sort of describe the importance of conversation and nuance within a paper's editorial pages? Like, how do you determine what's too far and what's not far enough? You know, I'm thinking here of the New York Times running the Tom Cotton op-ed, and which led ultimately to James Bennett's resignation.
I think there's a challenge that newspapers have, in that they have this tradition on their opinion pages, their editorial and op-ed pages, of trying to get ideological diversity. And in some sort of romanticized former era, which I don't think actually offered all that much true diversity on these pages, that meant you had conservatives and liberals writing on the issues of the day, but all sort of within this sort of kind of basic parameters of being grounded in the same empirical reality and also some degree of civility in terms of how they approach problems. That's not to say that I really buy that that was ever a perfect model, but I think what's clear about the world we're in now is that there's just so much more to not just the ideological spectrum, but the spectrum of viewpoints and policies and ideas that could be showcased on opinion pages and editorial pages. And so the problem of curating that and distilling that and deciding what really matters is much bigger and much harder, and it puts a lot more of a burden and a responsibility, I think, on editorial page editors and op-ed page editors to really handle that thoughtfully and think about, you know, are you just making a gesture because you want to prove that you're not a liberal institution to give the megaphone to someone who has an abhorrent point of view? Are you letting politicians go uninterrogated? Which I think in Tom Cotton's case, you know, he had this kind of point of view about sending troops into American cities that was violent and reckless, and he deserved to be interrogated, not necessarily just offered a free sort of platform to espouse, which is what an op-ed mm-hmm. essentially is. It's not a dialogue. One thing we've done at The Globe is we've started this series called Op Talks, where we actually let people express a strong point of view, but it's in dialogue with one of our editorial board members, and it's a way of kind of doing what we're doing now, right? Pushing back on ideas, mm-hmm. not letting people just let their lies stand, for example, or let some sort of really hateful point of view stand. And even then, you know, you have to be careful about who you invite to that platform and who you give that megaphone. I think we need diversity of views. We need debate. We need real rigorous debate. I believe in that strongly as an editorial page editor. I don't want to read pieces that I agree with all the time. I want to read pieces that challenge me. But I also think that it would be better, rather than trying to say, okay, we've got our token conservative, we've got our token socialist, we've got our token Democrat, we've got our, you know, token fascist. I don't know what people would do, ideally. If ideological diversity was really what you wanted, that could take you in a very dark direction if you went all the way to the extreme of that. But I think more important is to think about evidence-based thinkers who will surprise you and come to the editorial page or the op-ed pages with something that isn't predictable just based on where they grew up or how they vote. That is truly something they've scrutinized and wrestled with and looked at the evidence, and particularly in this society where, you know, we're being misinformed on Facebook all the time. We are struggling to converge on what is truth. It's, I think, more and more important for newspaper opinion pages and, frankly, for journalism in general to be more about grounding people in the truth as they build opinions and perspectives than it is to be about just showing that you're cool with all kinds of point of view.
You mentioned Op Talks, and I understand you recently had a Zoom conversation with Jake Auchincloss, who recently won the Democratic primary in Massachusetts. The Globe endorsed him. Could you speak to the endorsement? I'm curious, especially of the process that goes into that, because where do you see doing this talk, the paper endorsing? Where does the sort of journalistic integrity fall and editorial transparency come into all of that?
Yeah, it was a real test of our endorsement process. And I think, to me, has taught me a lot about what I want to do for our endorsement process going forward. So what happens in an endorsement is you have, you know, 16, 17 people in our case on the editorial board trying to distill a field. In this case, there were 9 candidates at the time we deliberated. And so what you're doing is you're converging around a candidate that the majority can get around. And so that process doesn't always lead to an outcome that everyone on the board loves or can live with. We also endorsed very early, and new information came out about the candidate after our endorsement that, frankly, wasn't part of our deliberation. Mm-hmm. And so I felt it was responsible to bring some of those issues up in a conversation in the op talk with the candidate and to kind of challenge him on some of the things he said, which were, you know, statements that raised the question in readers' minds of whether he was really willing to stand up for marginalized groups, whether he was the right leader for this time where we really need to address systemic racial injustice that's baked into the founding of this country and where we finally have more political will from citizens to do that. And there were real questions about that from just the collection of things he had said that our readers were concerned about. And so the conversation was a way of saying, you know, this endorsement is a snapshot in time, but now let's like continue this conversation because the vetting sort of continues. And that's kind of the reality of how it should work with anyone who holds office. You know, he will probably win the election if I had to predict it, because he's running against a Republican in the 4th Congressional District and it's a Democratic district. So this is a conversation that's going to keep going with him. And it's about what our role as an editorial board is, which is holding him accountable for the things he says he stands for.
Mm-hmm. At one point in time, you might endorse him, but at another point in time, you still have to hold them to task.
Absolutely. And if he runs against someone else in the future, there's no guarantee that we'll endorse him, right? Mm. It'll depend on a lot of factors.
It's also a fantastic, you know, efficient response to what's happening broadly in cancel culture, how you have said, no, we don't just let this lie unpacked. And I think that that was a really strong move forward in terms of how we need to have conversation and promote dialogue and allow nuanced, long conversation in response to something that can just be canceled immediately.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, I feel that that's true, that it's easier to shut someone down or decide that we're not going to hear from someone. But then actually, what do we learn for ourselves and for the future? And have we actually understood, right? Have we understood the motivations?
And we need journalists to model that for us. And so that's why I think it's such a profound moment in response. I wanted to switch gears a little bit before we let you go, but we're in this really uncertain moment in regards to education. Do we send our kids to school in person? Or are we just kind of headed into this accelerated new wave of infection? So you recently spoke to Ashish Jha, director of Harvard's International Wellbeing Institute. And I was just curious, because you heard it as sort of first order, what are you thinking about it? And what's changed in the couple of weeks since you spoke to him?
Well, I think he has a really good way of looking at this, which is that, you know, as we go into flu season, this could get a lot harder. I don't personally have kids, but I have very close nieces, you know, lots of kids in my life, godkids. And I really feel that this is such a challenging situation for parents, for kids. There's a lot of loss of learning, and especially for young kids, that has serious consequences. On the other hand, I'm not a teacher going back into the classroom, putting myself at risk in the classroom. So I think those choices are really hard to make in a kind of blanket way. And I think Dr. Jha really did raise some of that nuance and the tension about what's going on. I mean, I can't read the tea leaves. I hope springs eternal that in terms of the virus spreading, that it's not going to be so bad. I think with kids going back to school, if they're not wearing masks, if there's not a lot of careful consideration of all of the different aspects of containing the outbreak, that this could be really bad. But I also think that the alternative, especially of kids like city school kids, where there's such an achievement gap between them and, you know, suburban kids, that there has been, you know, if you have a working parent and no laptop for the kid, or even if you have a laptop and there's no one there to supervise the kid, you're talking like a kid who's like 6 years old, 5 years old, 3 years old, you know, what kind of learning can really happen remotely? So I do think it's just a rock and a hard place. It kind of brings me back to just the true horror of how this was handled in our country, and just the wish that we could turn back time and have had real leadership to deal with this, because it didn't have to be this bad. It really didn't have to be this bad. And so from here, I think we need new political leadership. We need people at the local and state level to really just be thoughtful and responsive to what the data are showing, like before it's too late, right? Like once you start seeing increased positivity rates, dial it back, bring people back. There might be new lockdowns in November, December. So I think it's just going to take precaution and a lot of compassion, right? This is about caring about people beyond your four walls, even though we're trapped in our four walls.
Yeah. Are you optimistic about the future?
I like to say that I'm an engaged optimist. People I know call me an optimist. I think it's because I'm often happy. But in terms of like, what do I really think is going to happen? I'm not the kind of optimist that is just sort of reading the tea leaves or the warning signs in society and thinking this is all going to be fine, particularly not with California burning and hurricanes bearing down on the Gulf Coast. But I am very much a person who believes that if we act, if we choose to act, that change is nonlinear, right? The trend lines we're seeing right now can be not only reversed, but dramatically changed if there's enough people who care enough to change them. And it doesn't have to be everyone, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be those people who are refusing to wear masks right now in Florida, but it needs to be enough people. And I think we're getting to that point on the climate crisis. I think we're certainly getting to that point on a lot of other issues in this country. And that actually makes me a bit hopeful, like cautiously hopeful. But the optimism really, I think, comes from action for me. It's just taking the actions for a future I don't know will happen, but that I want to happen. It's having enough optimism to believe it's possible.
Mm. On the subject of hope, what's your greatest hope as we emerge through this moment and whenever it is out of COVID?
I was actually asked this question not so long ago, and I feel it's a big hope. It's a kind of aspirational hope, perhaps idealistic. But if compassion and care for each other could be more of a measure of our progress rather than the size of our economy, the GDP, right? Like, how well are we taking care of each other? How compassionate are we to each other? And I think that goes for our political conversations, our public discourse, but it also goes for, you know, just how are we caring for the most vulnerable in our society? Like, what are we really doing to make the spoils of progress available, or at least at the very least, to alleviate people's true pain and hardship? And if we can make that the measure of our progress, if we can start to see how connected we are through these kind of crises, and that we haven't done that, that we've failed to do that to date, but that we actually care enough to do it, that would be amazing.
Bina, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
Thank you. I love talking to you both.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.